relief factor, pain relief that's natural, pain relief that works, and pain relief that attacks the source of the pain. That's the experience of tens of thousands of Americans who are taking Relief Factor right now. See their incredible video endorsements at ReliefFactor.com and then order your three-week quick starter pack for just $19.95. That's less than a dollar a day. Find out if it can work for you like it works for me by ordering your three-week quick starter pack today. ReliefFactor.com, ReliefFactor.com. Be the next success story.
Welcome, dear friends, to America First One-on-One. What a week it's been. Whilst a five-foot white bunny rabbit scared the current incumbent of the White House, apparently he told his former boss, Obama, yeah, he'll be running in 2024. And just a day later, what happened? Bernie Sanders! He came out of the graveyard, and like a zombie you can't get rid of, he says, I just might run as well. If you add Hillary reopening the Clinton Global Initiatives Foundation, it might just be a very, very full field on the Democrat side. What does it mean for the good guys? What does it mean for Republicans? We have returning to America First One-on-One. She is the Director of Policy at the Conservative Partnership Institute, Rachel Bovaard. Welcome in studio.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to see you.
So it feels like an old movie. It feels like the Democrat redux, the reimagining of the Democrat Party with less re than anything else. Do you give any credit, let's start with the opposition, to any of these? The idea that a man who has to be led off by a five-foot bunny is going to run in 2024 or Bernie's back, is this just a fantasy?
This is rule by the gerontocracy at this point is what we're dealing with. And, you know, it's part and parcel of what's wrong with our politics to begin with is that we don't have any new blood. We have no fresh ideas. We just have the same has-beens running over and over and over. And to top it off, these are people who have spent their careers in Washington, D.C., so they're not going to be the avatars of creative thinking.
For me, and you tell me if this makes sense to you as somebody who's worked on Capitol Hill, now working at the CPI, the choice of a machine politician from Delaware who's been in politics for 47 years, that choice back in 2015 wasn't well thought out. It wasn't part of some master conspiracy with Obama in a basement talking through an earpiece to Biden. This was the lazy choice. This was like the de facto, oh, we don't want Bernie. Hillary's out of the question. Let's go with, what's his name, Joe. It seemed lazy and also a function of identity politics. The idea that he chooses his running mate, a woman who got less than 2% in the Democrat primaries, who is now poised to become the president if he removes himself, this isn't very strategic, is it?
No, it wasn't well thought out for two reasons. I think the first that you point out, it's lazy, but it also felt kind of frantic to some extent when you point out Bernie was surging and they were like, we absolutely cannot have this, right? We cannot have someone who's going to disrupt the establishment. So it was almost this like immediate regression to the mean. Let's find the most establishment creature we can and the most predictable creature we can, push him up front. You know, we'll put the woman, the black woman next to him and it'll be fine, right? And everything will be good. And what they didn't account for, I think, is how much the country has changed and how much the expectations of our politicians have changed to the extent that Kamala Harris is like the least popular politician I think the world has ever seen.
Let's stop there for a second. Let's unpack that sentence because I think it's correct, but let's put some meat on the bone there. How much the country has changed. Talk to us about one or two of those big changes that you think the DNC and maybe the RNC haven't noticed.
Well, I think, you know, for a long time, there was an accepted elite consensus in Washington. And this goes by many names, right? It goes by the swamp. It goes by neoliberalism. It goes by whatever it is that you want to call
it. The Uniparty. The Bannon's Uniparty.
Right. And I think that, you know, for a long time, that was acceptable to voters, you know, for many reasons. You can point to the fact that politics wasn't people's entire lives at that point, right? So they were willing to sort of ignore what was going on. And I think that there's a very established way of doing things in Washington that still thinks that's acceptable, that still thinks that resonates. Because these people haven't left Washington in 35 years.
They have no idea.
They have no
idea. So this is one of my biggest problems with the GOP, and we're going to talk about the GOP in a moment, that a large chunk of the establishment Republican Party to this day, 5.5 years later, don't understand how a non-politician who'd never been a governor, never been a senator, never been a general, for the first time in our history, were elected one of those president. Is that an overstatement?
No, I mean, I think there's people that still to this day do not understand it. And this has been a process on the right in particular. This has been a process of intentional and willful disregard for big changes that were happening in the Republican base. I go all the way back to the Tea Party as the first shot across the bow. You know, in 2008, 2010, that was my political upbringing in many cases. You know, that was the first shot across the bow that something, there was a disconnect, a growing disconnect between the representatives in Washington and the base on the ground.
And then the Tea Party kind of disappeared or fizzled out.
It got co-opted, I think, by a lot of establishment interests.
But didn't the Trump MAGA America First phenomena, is it fair to say that was built on the rubble of the Tea Party?
I think that's right, because again, it goes back to this idea that it was this growing disconnect that wasn't addressed. Because people tried to make the Tea Party about a lot of things it wasn't. You know, they said, oh, it's only about deficit spending. Well, in part it was, but it was also about the massive amnesty that Republicans and Democrats were trying to pass. It was about Obamacare and the government taking over all of your choices. And there was a lot of interest in Washington in not addressing those things, right? And simply co-opting the energy into whatever the uniparty wanted it to be. So I think by the time we got to Trump, it was the voters saying simply like, we shot a bullet across the bow. Now we're sending you a missile because you have not heard us.
Right.
And I think in that intervening time, you know, things got even worse, to the point that I think voters very much recognized in Donald Trump a disruptor.
Yeah.
And someone who, in many cases, when you look at even just, you know, his positions on trade for how many years he held those positions.
Decades.
Yeah, decades that were going to disrupt, I think, a very big chunk of the elite consensus.
I think it's likely if we have reasonably fair elections that the Senate and the House will be in GOP hands. That's the only precondition of President Trump running again, because he can't be impeached day one of his second term. So as far as I'm concerned, if the midterms go well for Republicans, President Trump is running and he will win. Let's leave that up to the voters. But is it possible? I mean, of all these scenarios, what is the most likely? I don't believe Biden can run again. I think for various reasons, the DNC will not. I mean, he said on that interview, they asked him, what happens if you have a disagreement with Kamala? And he actually says on camera, I'll do what I said I would do with Obama, that if we have a policy in a disagreement, I'll come up with an ailment. He actually said that. I'll come up with an ailment and I'll resign. Well, he's already put that out there, so he could come up with an ailment in the next 3 years and just remove himself. So who's it going to be in 3 years? Is it going to be Kamala? Is it going to be Bernie? Is it going to be Hillary? Or is it going to be Mayor Pete? What are you putting your money on?
I do not think Joe Biden makes it through this term.
No.
And I'm not saying that that I wish any ill toward him.
No, he's just, the DNC won't permit it.
Correct. But I also think you're seeing it already, right? He's being disavowed across the establishment. So at that point, I think Kamala Harris runs. because
they can't get rid of it. You can't get rid of a black woman.
Right. They're stuck.
They're stuck with it.
Yeah, and I think they're stuck with Mayor Pete, too. And between the two of them, they were two of the most unlikable candidates.
So is he going to be her Veep?
That's fascinating. I also have this weird theory that Mitt Romney's trying to position himself for that job, but we'll see.
On the Democrat side?
Yeah.
That would be rather poetic, indeed. All right, we're talking to Rachel Bovard. You've got to follow her right now on Twitter, policy director for the Conservative Partnership Institute. Of course, Mark Meadows is a good friend of the show. He is at the CPI. One of the issues that I'm most concerned with is personnel for 2024. I know he's working on that issue. You're a big expert on big tech. We'll discuss that as well. If you enjoyed this show, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. It's absolutely free. Go right now to Spotify. Plug in my name, Sebastian Gorka. The price is right. It's absolutely free. Make sure you never miss an episode. That's America First, Sebastian Gorka. Write a little review and please do share the content with your friends. Additionally, this isn't NPR, So we don't get $500 million of your taxpayer money every single year. This is a free market enterprise. As such, we rely upon you to make this show possible. How do you do that? You support those who support us. Great Americans, great patriots like Mike Lindell, the president's friend, the inventor of My Pillow, the pillow that never gets soft, never gets hot. 51 million sold. They're that good. I use them. My whole team uses them. Right now, the left wants to destroy Mike. Even his bank have shut down 9 of his bank accounts, including his personal bank account and the one for the foundation that supports former drug addicts. They hate this man and they want to crush him. We cannot let that happen. Please support him today the way he supports us. Go to MyPillow.com, use my promo code GORKA, order whatever you want, and Mike will give you up to 66% off. You can also call them on 800-829-8468. That's 800-829-8468, mypillow.com. But you've got to use the promo code for those massive discounts. It's GORKA. If you haven't done so already, book your tickets for our Stand With Israel tour. 10 days later this year, we are traveling to the Holy Land with my superb Salem colleague, Dinesh D'Souza, and his lovely wife, Debbie. If you've never been to the Holy Land, to walk where our Lord and Savior walked the earth, this is the time. The places you've read about, Jerusalem, the Temple Mount, the Garden of Gethsemane, the shores of the Sea of Galilee, you will be there. Even if you've been to Israel before, you haven't been with me and Dinesh. It's the trip of a lifetime. They realize they got it wrong with their vaccination policies. I'm not vaccinated and I'm going. Join us. Please call today to reserve your tickets. 855-565-5519. That's 855-565-5519 or standwithisraeltour.com. That's standwithisraeltour.com. Mike Lindell has a true passion to help everyone get the best sleep of their lives. Therefore, he created the Giza Dream bed sheets. They look and feel incredible, which translates to an even better night's sleep for you. Mike's latest amazing deal is the sale of the year. For a limited time, you will receive 60% off the Giza Dream sheets that come with a 60-day money-back guarantee and a 10-year warranty. You'll receive a full set for as low as $39.99. And for a limited time, with any purchase, you'll receive Mike's soft cover book free when you use promo code GORKA. Go to MyPillow.com, click on the radio listener square, and use promo code GORKA. Along with this offer, you'll also get deep, deep discounts on all his MyPillow products, including the MyPillow mattress topper, MyPillow towel sets, and so much more. Call 800-829-8468, promo code GORKA. Just go to MyPillow.com, promo code GORKA. Rachel, you're a frequent contributor at The Federalist, I believe, and you write on Senate congressional procedure, given your expertise on the Hill, and then your big bugbear is, of course, big tech. Super exciting to watch what's happening with Elon Musk and Twitter. It sounds like this is a man who wants more freedom of speech. I don't think he's a classic conservative. I think if you look at the posts he's made in the last 6 months, he's politically wakening up, maybe a libertarian of sorts. Talk to us about your analysis of the reaction of big tech to all of this. I had Alex Marlowe on my show saying, can't trust this guy. He's doing work with communist China. He has all kind of NDAs with people who work for him at Tesla. Not really a free speech guy. Alex might be right, but for me, they're really worried in Palo Alto. Why are they so worried, Rachel?
So I think Elon Musk has honed in on something particular and unique to Twitter, which if you consider Twitter in the ecosystem of big tech, it is actually quite small compared to Google, compared to Facebook. Those are the behemoths. Twitter's pretty small. But what
small in sense of what? They don't make any money, or small in the sense of how much information they process? Because nobody's close to Google, right?
Right. No, they don't make that. They're like a notoriously bad at making money.
How do they not make money? Can we just stop there for a second?
They haven't really.
How does the biggest mini blog, micro blog site in the world not make money?
they haven't really monetized the platform in a way. And in part, I support this, right, because they don't track you in the way that Google and Facebook do. But they also just haven't, you know, remember, they banned political advertising. You know, they've taken these very woke stands on things, which, you know, we know hurts the bottom line. But in reality, they're quite small. But what Twitter has that the other two platforms don't is this outsized control of elite narrative formation, right? It is where the cable news media talks to each other. It is where news stories begin and end.
And it's where reporters think the real world is.
So
the Washington Post doesn't actually do reporting. They go and check on Twitter.
But it's a huge, compared to Twitter's size, that influence that it has is massive because it controls, in many ways, the national conversation, the national discourse. So it is, you know, there's a lot of people that say, well, why do we care about Twitter? It's not that big. Well, no. Twitter's impact on how we consume the news, how our news is framed, what kind of information gets transmitted is massive. And I think Elon Musk has picked up on that. Because in that clip, he talks about, you know, having this kind of free speech is really important. And he says, I don't care about the economics at all.
He actually says that at the end. I'm not in it to make money, which is quite stunning for a guy who's the richest man in the world.
Right. Well, he can say that, right? There's probably no one else that can say
it. No, but when you're dropping $42 billion on the table, $15 billion of which is yours, he's in it for principle. But do you trust him? That's the question. Do you think he's in it for the principle? Or because people say, well, he offered at a below market rate. It's not serious. The offer he made was, you know, marijuana day. He's just having fun. He's just trolling Twitter. My response is, if you make an offer, they could call your bluff and accept it. And that's a pretty expensive practical joke, isn't it?
I get the sense he is in it for the principle. Now, I take the position that I don't know if I trust him in the long term. I have no data points for this, right? I do think he has some very concerning entanglements with the Chinese. But he is also, I think, of that breed of Gen X that grew up with this sort of tech exceptionalism, this idea that the internet could be the great equalizer, that it was a decentralized, community-moderated place. It was supposed to be. And it was in the beginning. I grew up in the 90s. I kind of remember the internet this way. Now it's nothing like that, right? Yeah. Now it's a series of vertically integrated walled gardens. You know, it is completely monetized, and it's moderated by these completely, you know, woke people in Silicon Valley. It's nothing like what it was. But I think he really holds on to that nostalgia that a lot of people in his generation do. And I really do think he wants to infuse Twitter with that. Whether or not he'll be successful, I can't say. But I do, it's been interesting to me that he stuck with it this far. I thought he was going to walk away. I thought he was going to dump his shares and walk away when they rejected his offer. He hasn't. As of today, he's putting together potentially a tender offer, you know, that, and he's secured the financing. You don't take those steps if you aren't at least 50% serious.
And allegedly, there are people in Wall Street who are considering, there are investment companies, hedge funds that are considering going in with Elon to make an even bigger offer. So whatever the final result, this is a significant story, isn't it?
It's a huge story. It's a huge story. And the reaction to it, I think, tells you how big of a deal it is, because the elite sort of media, mainstream corporate outlets, they recognize how significant this is. They have control of this, which means they control the conversation. They let other voices in, and it's been so telling, not just in the sense that they've said, we don't want more free speech or free speech is dangerous. You saw, even this week, Matt Iglesias, who is former writer for Vox, now runs a Substack, is saying, what we've realized is that there's some people that don't deserve to speak in the public square. They're actually saying this out loud, and it's something we all knew, but to hear them say it, I think, is just a stunning off.
Who said that?
Matt Iglesias.
Fox?
No, Vox.
Vox. Okay.
Not to be confused with Fox.
But it's very clear. I mean, if it's your billionaire, if it's the left's billionaire, if it's Bezos, it's okay. He can buy the Washington Post. He can have this little vanity project of his. But if it's somebody who's not a Republican, but not a Democrat, then that's the real issue.
The one thing I will say, though, that I hate about this is that fact, is that we are in a situation where we have to beg billionaires for access to the public square.
We'll talk about what should be happening instead in a moment. This is America First, one-on-one, coming to you from the ReliefFactor.com studios, just outside the insalubrious, fetid swamp that is Washington, D.C. With me, your host, Sebastian Gorka. I never mention this. Maybe once a month I do. You can follow me on social media as well. Seb Gorka, Sebastian Gorka, all the platforms except YouTube, because they're fascists. It is shocking. It is horrifying. Every day we see the latest reports. We see the evidence of war crimes in Crimea. We see the foreign minister of Ukraine give interviews in English about Mariupol fundamentally not existing anymore as a city because of what the Russians have done to the civilians there. What can we do? This administration is not doing enough. We're not talking about intervention. We're talking about helping the Ukrainians fight for themselves. However, there's something that you can do. Right now, we have the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews that is flying refugee aid into Ukraine. Food, water, medicine, clothing for the women and children who are still there and who are suffering. Make a difference today. Make a donation in any amount, and you are literally saving lives. Will you please call the fellowship on 800-970-5010, or just go to my website, sebgorka.com, and click on the Crisis in Ukraine banner at the top. Donate as little as you want. Donate as much as you can, because this is a tragedy unfolding before our eyes, and we can make a difference. That number for the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews is 800-970-5010, or just go to sebgorka.com, S-E-B-G-O-R-K-A, and click on the Crisis in Ukraine banner at the very top.
This is a red alert for hardworking Americans who are tired of seeing their freedoms and savings threatened by the globalist agenda. Wealth Protection Research is on a mission to find whistleblowers who are exposing the schemes that threaten your financial security. We're talking about real, patriotic financial warriors like Jim Rickards and Porter Stansberry. They're not afraid to tell it like it is, exposing how the system is rigged against you. Text IDEAS to 76626 to find out more. With the 2024 election storming our way, your IRA and your 401k appear to be in the crosshairs. That's why we've compiled our three favorite ideas from freethinkers. Don't wait for a knock on your door telling you it's too late. Get this critical report. Text IDEAS to 76626. The fight for your financial freedom is on. Text IDEAS to 76626 now for your free report. That's IDEAS to 76626. Standard text and data rates may apply.
Rachel, you're an expert, and sadly we need this in this city on process as well, not just the fun, meaty stuff of rhetoric and policies. You know how the sausage factory works on Capitol Hill. Can you give us a letter grade? You're the professor now. Give us a letter grade. And we keep hearing Mitch McConnell's this genius and judge appointments, blah, blah, blah. What's the right grade for how the Republican Party understands and uses the tools available to them on Capitol Hill?
Oh, it's, a D minus, okay. Unfortunately.
Why? What, is it ignorance? Is it uniparty business as usual? Why are they so ineffectual? Because it seems as if the old saw is right, that when we're in opposition, we act like we're in opposition. When we're in the majority, we act like we're in the opposition still. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really interesting. I think it was a trend that really started 10 or 15 years ago under then Democratic Majority Leader Harry Reid. And it's been continued, I think, under Mitch McConnell, which in particular in the Senate, where the Senate's built around the rights of the minority party. Unlike the House, which is very majoritarian, the Senate, every senator has almost equal authority. But what began under Reid, continued under McConnell, was this notion that the Senate should be run very top down, and the thing that they should never do is vote on anything.
And hang on, explain that.
Because it was this idea that, you know, voting puts vulnerable senators at risk, right? You don't want to make Lisa Murkowski vote on too many pro-life bills. You know, that might put her at risk in Alaska. And it was this very political mentality, which I think personally has destroyed the Senate. Because if you think about it, the Senate, between the House and the Senate's supposed to be where deliberation takes place. Yeah. And the more the Senate votes, the more information voters have about where people stand. You know, you force Democrats into these really difficult postures.
So when did that start?
It really started, I think, probably 10 or 15 years ago under Reid. And it's been a slow descent ever since. And occasionally you'll see senators push back on this because, you know, even Republicans, and you're in a tied Senate right now, but even when Republicans are in the minority, every senator has the right to demand and receive a vote on whatever they want. How many times do you see people use it?
You don't.
Hardly at all.
You don't.
Every now and then you'll see the Rand Pauls of the world, the Mike Lees of the world, the Ted Cruzes of the world. But the social opprobrium from doing that is very difficult. Look right now at the tension going on between Mitch McConnell and Senator Rick Scott from Florida. Rick Scott put out an agenda. He said, this is what we should run on. And there's a lot you can agree or disagree with, but he had ideas. After McConnell was like, we're going to have no agenda. We're going to run on how bad the Democrats are. The fact that Rick Scott had an independent thought is the most offensive thing that Mitch McConnell has experienced in the last year. And you're just seeing them butt heads over it. They don't like independent thinkers.
And what about the House? We have these regular, we call them America First strategy sessions in studio with Matt Gaetz and Marjorie Taylor Greene. And Matt talked about his vision. If we trounce the Democrats in the midterms, he wants every committee of the House to become an investigatory committee issuing subpoenas, getting serious about oversight. Is that a pipe dream, Rachel?
I don't think it is. And even more than that, I would say the January 6th Select Committee has been a stain on the House. But what it's also done is it's shown how powerful Select Committees are. The precedent Democrats have created here is stunning.
And a precedent that's dangerous for them.
It is. Well, if it's turned on them, if Republicans take that precedent that heretofore didn't exist and they turn it on Democrats, Democrats are in for a world of pain.
But would this GOP get serious about oversight?
That's the question.
Isn't it?
That's the big one. And I don't know.
She's not going to answer it. We'll pry a little bit deeper momentarily. This is America First, one-on-one. Okay. I could ask you so many other questions. Let's start with the one that I ask every member of Congress and the only senator I allow on this show, who is Marsha Blackburn, because she's more of a citizen than a politician. All the others think they're going to be future presidents.
That's every senator.
It is.
Your qualification for being a senator.
I can't abide it. It's like every single one thinks they're the future president. No, you arrogant little person with no charisma. You're never going to be president.
The only one who doesn't is Mike Lee, because he wants to be on the Supreme Court.
There you go. One exception. And Marsha, who's
and Marsha, yeah.
Who's great. Okay. The big picture for me is the following. The GOP and the Democrats really still don't know what happened in 2015, 2016. Donald Trump was this iconoclastic character who really didn't even have an ideology that you can squish into a standard taxonomy. He's not neoliberal, paleocon. He's just a guy who loves America, wants to shut the border and get government out of the way. Very, very simple. It's not a deep theoretical analysis of political science. Since then, we've had this kind of Tea Party morphing into MAGA candidates, MAGA politicians, the ones who come on this show, the people who believe in America First, the blue-collar Democrats that voted for Reagan, that we see a new generation of them. Where is the party today? Where is our party, Rachel? In the Cold War, in national security, my former field, we have this phrase, the correlation of forces. Or the balance of power, as you looked at the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact and NATO and America, who's more powerful? That was what you measured every single year. What is the correlation of forces? What is the balance of power today on our side of the aisle? When you look at the establishment party, you look at the rhinos, the never Trumpers, the go along to get alongs, the Mitch McConnells, the Paul Ryan leftovers. How is their power relationship with MAGA and America First? Because it seems very fluid, and we don't have that same structure of opposition leader here that we do in parliamentary systems. So where do you see the trend going and who's winning?
I think this is a tension within the Republican Party that plays out every single day in Washington.
Yeah.
I do think there is a strong contingent in Washington that doesn't represent the country, but very strong here in D.C., that wishes Donald Trump never happened, mm-hmm. that is actively trying to put every force he unleashed back into the box. Yeah. And make it go away.
Or just ignore it.
And pretend it never happened.
Right.
Right. Wish it away. Wish casting in some ways. But the base of the party is not there. I think the base of the Republican Party is far more skeptical of previous alliances within our domestic sphere than it's ever been. They are skeptical of the free market as it's been wielded against them and captured by a certain ideology. You know, we talk about the financial sector, cutting people off from their banks. Like, this is not the free market that we grew up in. How do we get it back to neutral? They are skeptical of concentrated power inside and outside of the government, not just within the government itself, but from Google, right? Aligning with China. How is that helpful? They are far more aware, I think, of the forces that are impacting them that are outside of their control, that have very much been influenced by the policy choices made here in Washington. So that split I talked about between the base and the leadership of the party, I think, still exists, but it's not a secret anymore. It is very, very much in the open, and I think people are paying more attention to politics than they've ever been because they have to.
So it's clear that everything is politicized today, from traveling on a plane to what your children are learning in school. And that idea that we have a base that is more cognizant mm-hmm. of that politicization is clearly obvious. But when it comes to this city, if you take a snapshot, what is the GOP today? Who's running it? Who's gaining control? And who's losing control? Is it even possible to say? Or do we have to wait until the midterms?
I think the midterms will give us a lot of instruction. I think the Republican leadership in both the House and the Senate is not nearly prepared to lead us through this moment, and that is my very frank assessment. I think there are members of Congress who very much understand the nature of the threat, and you are seeing them, get supported in that, right? Look at someone like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who the establishment hates, and I always think who the establishment hates is a very instructive object lesson. They hate her. They have tried to strip her of every possible power mechanism in Washington, and yet she is outraising, every member of Congress almost, because the base of the party, she's resonating. What she's fighting for resonates with them. They feel like they are being represented. So I think there are members of Congress that definitely understand this. The leadership the structure that's been in Washington is just, we talk about rule of gerontocracy, it's right there.
Yeah.
And they are
it's like the Politburo in the 1980s.
Yeah. And they're very attached to their ways of doing doing things. But I do think that they are under threat in a way they haven't been. And I think, the House dynamic, if Republicans take back the House, that's going to be a very interesting thing to watch, that dynamic between the House Freedom Caucus and Kevin McCarthy, if he's elevated into the speakership.
And allegedly, he does talk to them and wants some advice from them. So we'll see whether that changes after the midterms. Okay, let's admit something that perhaps we don't want to admit. You and I eat, sleep, and drink politics. We love it, even though it's filthy business. However, most elections aren't won on the right or the left. They're won in the middle, where somebody who has no political identity decides to vote for a certain party at the day of the election, so the floating voter, pocketbooks and everything else. Talk to us about what you're seeing or what your expectations are for the working class in America and the mythical, legendary, suburban White House wife. Under COVID, the gas prices, immigration, supply chain, are we seeing interesting shifts? I think it's obvious with the Hispanic community, a lot of them not happy with this administration. Could the establishment, the Uniparty, be very surprised by what happens in November with those constituents?
I think we're seeing something similar play out to what happened with Donald Trump, when everyone was so surprised that Donald Trump was able to put together the coalition that he did. Take that and turn up the volume about times 10, because Democrats have politicized every kitchen table issue that you can possibly imagine, not just economically, although we see it in the gas prices, we see it in inflation, we see it in supply chain. They've politicized your kids going to school. Yeah. They've politicized putting men in women's sports, right? I don't care on what side of the aisle you sit. If you are a suburban white female and your daughter's leg is getting broken on the soccer field by a biological boy, right? Like, that is going to radicalize people in ways that I don't think Democrats have fully grappled with. Now, I will say this. If those voters swing to the right, it is because of Democrats, right? Democrats have pushed them there. It's not because Republicans have necessarily earned their trust. So it's not a durable coalition in that sense, I think. And I think the right has to wake up to that. If there is this mythical red wave, many of those voters are not coming with traditional, like, you know, allegiances.
It's not an ideological affinity.
Right. They're not coming because they've eaten and read Milton Friedman for the past 20
years. Right. And they're not walking around with a MAGA hat on, but at the end of the day, it still means a victory.
So they have to figure out a way to speak to those voters if they're going to make that coalition last.
We're talking to Rachel Bovard of the Conservative Partnership Institute. I'm Sebastian Gorka. This is America First One-on-One, coming to you from the ReliefFactor.com studios. The topic, I think, that I won't say excites you, maybe agitates you the most, is big tech. We've only got a few minutes left, so we're going to follow what Elon does, how he acquires more and more enemies from the establishment every single day. I want to put you on record right now. Whatever happens to Twitter and him, what do we do about big tech? How do we solve this? There's a couple of ideas been floating around for years. Break them up, remove their 230 immunity, charge them with cartelism. We don't see any significant movement. What is, as far as you're concerned, the correct way to begin?
You have to subject them to the rule of law. You know, what we have here is what we've had in many cases, which is, you know, innovation that began in a good way, but has come to change how we live together, how we speak, how we interact, and the nature of our self-government. It is incumbent upon the self-government to assert itself over these companies. What does that look like? I think it actually does look like, in some cases, breaking them up. I think Google is large enough that it needs to be spun off, you know, from its ad business. Search and ads and everything that goes into Google and YouTube shouldn't all be under one company. But I think for platforms like, you know, Facebook, you might want to look at something like common carriage, right? And what I mean by that is, you know,
like a utility.
Like a utility, right? If you look at something like Facebook, it is almost critical election infrastructure at this point. Like, if you are banned as a politician from speaking on Facebook, you are losing a critical access point to voters. You know, we need to consider that in how we treat these platforms. And I'm not just talking about Google and Facebook. We need to look at Amazon, who, you know, discriminates against small sellers, who, you know, in many cases is predatory against them.
Or censors books.
And censors books. And, you know, when you look at Apple in particular and Google, you have this homogenization effect that they have on the app stores, right? If you look at something like Truth Social, they can say they're you know, same thing with Parler. They wanted to moderate on the First Amendment. Apple said, no, if you do that, we'll kick you out of our store. So I think we need to look at all these things and where reasonable, I think, put reasonable measures that allow people to access what is now a digitally controlled public square. So that's not a silver bullet. I think it looks like common carriage. I think it looks like breaking up companies where appropriate. It looks like non-discrimination. It looks like all those things.
And will the GOP do that if they're in power, Rachel?
I am hopeful. Let's put it that way. But I haven't seen the amazing ideas I'm hoping to see.
All right, guys, it's up to us. We can make a difference. Support those MAGA candidates. Be that MAGA candidate. Then we can keep the establishment's feet to the fire. You've been listening to America First One-on-One. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast. Go to your favorite platform. Plug in my name. Share the links. Write a review. It makes a difference. And given that it's Friday, we'll end as ever with my future boss. Did I just say that? Let's just say my former and maybe future boss, President Trump.
We will not bend. We will not break. We will not yield. We will never give in. We will never give up. We will never back down. We will never, ever surrender. My fellow Americans, our movement is far from over. In fact, our fight has only just begun.
Our fathers brought forth upon this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death.
The world will little note or long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here.
I have a dream. Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
I can hear you. The rest of the world hears you. And the people...
And we will make America great again.
This is America First with Sebastian Gorka.
Can it possibly be? Is it Friday? Are you in a Friday mood? Welcome, dear friends. Greetings to America First on the Salem Radio Network and the Salem News Channel. If I haven't discussed it enough, do check out the Salem News Channel on all your devices like Roku. We are streaming the video of all our radio shows, all your favorites like Dennis Prager, Charlie Kirk, myself. You can watch in full glorious, is it Technicolor? And if you enjoy podcasting, we're on all the usual podcast platforms. It is Happy Friday, Happy Second Amendment Friday, because that's what we do here. It's Ask Dr. G. What is going on? I haven't even given out the flipping phone number, and we've already got three calls. Maybe people already know. Maybe of the 3 million people listening, most of you know that's Friday, which means it's Ask Dr. G Anything Friday. All right, let's mention the phone number so we can fill in the last two lines on our call board. It's 833-33-GORKA, G-O-R-K-A. That's 833-334-6752. Ask anything today, because that's what we let you do on Friday. I know we'll get some movie questions, some firearms questions. We've got a special a Second Amendment guest later on. We've got Jim Carafano. Just saw him moments ago on Fox News. Fascinating details about what's happening in Ukraine, the siege tactics being deployed by Russia. We'll have an update from Jim in studio. Robbie Starbuck with some news out of Tennessee. Not good. The GOP are playing dirty. We're going to give you all the details. And then, of course, you, our dear caller and listener. But first, yesterday, the Heritage Foundation, which has been lambasted unfairly by some in the MAGA movement as corporate conservatism. No, no, no. Especially under their new president, Kevin Roberts. Well, guess who spoke at their special event yesterday? None other than my former boss, President Trump. And I want you to watch the whole video. It's not a long speech. We'll post it on our Twitter feeds, our Truth Social, Facebook. But here is just 17 seconds that is a perfect summary of the situation we find ourselves in without President Trump in the White House. Cut 12.
Our movement must continue to pursue a populist, nationalist, economic agenda that puts working families before globalist politicians and woke multinational corporations who are mentally ill in many cases. They're sick.
It's very simple. We have created, out of the ashes of the Tea Party movement that I'm sure many, many of you were involved with, that was truly grassroots, really didn't have some sexy national leadership, people with big egos. Out of that, which the GOP really never, never internalized, President Trump created the America First movement. It is a populist, nationalist movement in the good sense of the word, not the way the left have spun it to make the word nationalist pejorative. Let's stop for a second. How is it possible that nationalism is bad? If nationalism is bad, then shouldn't we not have nations? The system we live in with 200 countries around the world, scholars call the Westphalian nation state system, is the system we live in. We went from feudal societies, colonies, monarchies, tribal systems, to one in which the modern nation state was created, where the concept of citizenship was established, with the Treaty of Westphalia in 1648 being the watershed, saying we have a new international system and it has objects in it. And those objects are nation states. And how are they defined? They have territory, they have sovereignty, and they have borders. And the business of one nation's internal structure and politics is the sovereign preserve of that nation. Others can run things the way they want to run things. If you want to be a constitutional monarchy like the UK, okay. If you want to be part of some international commonwealth like Australia, fine. If you want to have a republic, as we are, then that's the system we choose for ourselves as Americans. That's the system. So believing in your nation is a prerequisite, is it not? What is wrong in saying, yeah, I'm a nationalist? The left, after the 20th century, after fascism, after the Nazis, managed to tar that word with a brush that is negative, leaves a bad taste in the mouth. But where do they live? Where do the liberal elites live? Do they live in some non-nation state paradise of Starbucks for free and Netflix for free? Or do they live not far from this studio, in Adams Morgan, in Georgetown, in a part of the United States that is a republic? Well, of course they do. And of course it is the right. In fact, it is the duty of every nation state to stand up for its national values. Some of them may be bad guys. Absolutely. Putin, KGB colonel. Got it. That's Russia. Xi Jinping in China. Got it. Bad guy. Communist. The mullahs in Iran. But it is their job to represent their nation. In good countries like ourselves, it's the responsibility of our representatives to preserve those values. And that's what the president is talking about. Why? This is a realization I came to a couple of years ago. The problem we face from Obama, I think Democrat presidents, even probably Clinton, would have to be on the positive side of this equation. From Clinton on back, they believed in America. They may have been garbage presidents like Carter. But with Obama and with Biden, what we have is an elite. This is the paradox. This is the perverse paradox we are in. We have people who ran for the presidency, who became the commander-in-chief, who don't believe in the nation they represent. What kind of pervert decides to run for a position where they'll be the chief executive of a country they hate? What kind of person becomes president and the first thing they do is go on an international apology tour like Obama did? It's perverse. It's abnormal. We're seeing it again with this senile old man who's just a shadow of Obama. President Trump is the opposite. He loves America. I can assure you, having worked for him, having sat across the resolute desk in the Oval Office with only two of us in the Oval Office, this is a man who loves America, saw a broken America, saw a corrupt Washington, and said, you know what? I spent 50 years building things, building amazing things, and somebody needs to fix this. I'm not doing it for the money. I'm not doing it for the fame. But I'm doing it because I'm a patriot. That's who he is. And his speech yesterday is seminal. You've got to listen to his speech at the Heritage Foundation, along with perhaps the most important speech he ever gave, that I was proud to be involved in its shaping and its forming. And that's his Warsaw speech, where he talked about us having the courage to defend our civilization from those who wish to destroy it. Nothing's changed since he gave that speech, except more people inside America want to destroy America. I'm Sebastian Gorka, former strategist to President Trump. This is America First. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast. Go right now to Spotify. Plug in my name, Sebastian Gorka, America First. It's free. Never miss a moment. We'll be back here on the Salem Network.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.